I'm very happy now to welcome Kamaju Tadfor. He is organizer of Fiesta Fela, which is happening this Saturday, the 11th of October, at the Santa Fe Rail Yard from 11 to 7 in the evening. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
October 15th is the birthday of Fela Kuti. If he had lived, he would have been 76 this year. Who was he?
Well, first of all, Fela was an African revolutionary. He was a musician, a human rights activist, a fighter for social justice, but his revolutionary credentials, you know, are indisputable. Fela was born in Abeokuta from a very middle-class family, but he dropped out of all that. His dropout started when he went to England, and his family sent him there to study medicine, but he decided to study music instead. And coming from the kind of class he came from, you know, playing music was, you know, like, it was like, I mean, in Africa, music is mostly for charity. We don't have professional musicians. When you play music, people spray you and give you money as a gift. You know, they don't pay you a performance fee.
Right.
So it was like becoming a beggar.
Right.
So,
and he was expected to become a distinguished
medical doctor. His brother, for a start, was a medical doctor who ended up as the country's minister for education. So this is the kind of upbringing and the kind of pedigree that he was supposed to follow.
Now, he was in Nigeria.
Yes, 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 this was in Nigeria.
And so he went to England from Nigeria. He decided not to become a doctor. He studied music. What happened then?
Well, after he finished his musical studies, he came back home. I mean, to a lot of controversy, but he came back home to a very supportive mother. And he started playing his music. Around 1969, he decided, like all African musicians, we think the other man's grass is always greener. He came over to America to perform and also to study. But when he came here, he, instead of just performing and going back home, he decided to stay for he took a brief sabbatical here, still studying music. He was mostly in LA, where he met a lot of people, musicians, and other people like the Black Panther Party and people like that. He met a lady called Sandra, you know, who he had a liaison with, and she was also a member of the Black Panther Party, who started educating him about the African struggle. And Fela himself always says that until he came to America, he didn't understand the politics of racism. And I mean, his mother had been an anti-colonialist and a fighter against colonization in Africa, but he was not really politicized until he came here to America.
So the idea of this man becoming really politicized by the civil rights movement and the American Black Power movement. Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting cross-fertilization of ideas.
Oh, yes. Now, the thing is, colonialism and slavery was one and the same thing. But a lot of people don't understand that. I mean, in Africa, the colonial master was like a slave master. It's just that, he ruled literally with the whip. He took all our land. We became plantation workers in our own land without pay. You know, living in compounds, and you know, it was just exactly what was happening out here in the South. As I hear, I wasn't in America, and so we had gone through the blacks in America, and the Africans had gone through exactly the same experiences. That a portion of them had been removed from their homeland, but with us, we were actually at home, but going through the same experience. And with the American system of education and everything, the fight for independence in Africa was led by a lot of people who had been colonized, and the colonial master saw the expense of being physically in Africa. So he had decided when what Macmillan called the wind of change started blowing in Africa, and Africans started agitating for independence. The colonial master decided to accommodate that movement and train, especially, you know, train a group of people that they wanted to take over. You know.
Train African people.
Oh, yes, yes. You know, it was nothing less than organizing like overseers in your farm, you know.
Right.
And, but the system hadn't changed after independence. So we were still being ruled by the whip. We were still being given orders. And to tell you the truth, up till today, the African leaders, or I don't call them leaders, the African rulers are just appendages of their colonial, you know, masters. You know, they're just there. If you see news coming from Africa today, poverty, disease, everything, but we're in the land of plenty. The oil companies, I mean, now it might not be exactly the government of the metropolitan country, but they have now made it so that we have corporations that are in league with all those rulers, and I mean, Gulf Oil takes half and they give another half to the people that they put there, their overseers, and the people live in penury.
Right, you know? And so get illnesses from all the toxicity.
And they suffer all kind of illness. I mean, a lot of African leaders, when you hear they die in a European hospital somewhere or in an American hospital, they've been evacuated because there are no hospitals, no medical facilities and everything like that. I mean, this is all deliberate. So Fela saw all this happening, and then when he came here, because of the political awareness of the radicalization of the political movement in America, you know, civil rights movement, like I said, and the more radical student movements, you know, he started getting aware, he started becoming aware of how this situation here was, you know, the same situation that we were facing in Africa.
It's an interesting moment in history of a sense of African Americans and Africans identifying with one another. I don't know where that is now.
Well, that is still going on now. As a child of the 60s myself, I came to America in 99, and I had been influenced in my own personal life by the likes of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and people like that, Stokely Carmichael. Those are the, when in my teenage time, those are the people who were leading the movement. Though, like I said, that movement is still going on and is still strong, I find that the sense of urgency has left the American movement. You know, now there is this craziness for money. There's everybody is in the bling. And the thing about money is that it convinces you that you too can make it, which is not really true. When you see a young boy from the ghetto who goes to prison and come out and can tell his prison life in a rap song, that's very good and proper. But when after that he's paid some few dollars, and then the next thing he has is sitting at the back of a Beamer, as they call it, with the gold teeth, and telling all his fellow guys from the ghetto that he's made it, he can buy everything in the world, he can have as many women as he likes. I mean, that seems to be the focus of life here now. And I'm not saying that they're not serious people. They are. But the thing is that because, again, of the commercialization of our world, the media, those are the kind of people that the media projects to, the kind of image that the media projects to other people, other young people in the ghetto. So you have to work harder now for that urgency, for that message to come through.
Now, speaking of having many women, Fela Kuti, and we're talking about the Fiesta Fela, which is happening this Saturday. He at some point got married to, what, over 20 women?
Fela had 27 wives.
27 wives.
Well, he had
at
more
the
than 27
time.
Wives. He married 27 at the same time, yes.
Yeah.
Well, again, that is Fela, the contradiction in Fela's life. And there are many, but that's one of them. But apart from the contradiction and the whole spectacular part about it, Fela had reasons for doing what he was doing. One is that he was an African, and we basically are polygamous. I mean, it's a fact, and it's a system that's accepted and lived in our society. Right now, in 2014, if you go to Cameroon, to Nigeria, to you don't be surprised that you find a man with 10, 15 wives. We might not all agree with that, but I'm talking about the reality of what we're living. But next to that, Fela had a different reason for marrying this woman. Like I said before, entertainment, the entertainment world is not a very glamorous world in Africa. They don't look at you as a big star. You're a girl on stage. The normal appellation is harlot. So Fela actually married these girls to give them respectability. He was telling them, these are my wives. He called them queens, actually. These are my wives. These are my queens. You don't mess with them.
Now, were they singing with him on stage?
They were all okay. These were all his actresses and dancers, his singers and dancers. They were all his singers and dancers that he married, you know. And there's a precedent to this. We have a famous actor in America called Egunde. He's of late now. You see, when he told a story about when he started his acting troupe, he will see. It was easier to find young boys and men because men are allowed to be independent in my society, but women are not. So when he would approach a young girl's parents and said, oh, I have a drama group. I want your daughter to come and sing and dance with me. No father would allow that. No father would allow that. So he decided to ask the hand of this girl as in marriage, and the parents knew he was married, but they were prepared to give their daughter as a second or third or fourth wife to him, and he married the girls, and they became his singers. And so his whole family, Ogunde had a family of about 144 in his, not wives, I mean his children. His children all grew up to become part of his band, his ensemble, you know. So what Fela did, like I said, is manifold, you know. Apart from giving these girls the kind of respectability that you don't see a girl, once you see a girl in the bar singing on stage and dancing provocatively, it's a highlight. Because people used to come to the shrine and actually pull girls off stage like, oh, I'll take you home, I'll give you money. I like, they were, you know, literally prostitutes. And that was actually what Fela did that for.
We're talking to Kamaju Tadfor about Fiesta Fela. So he was very politicized. He was also the creator of the Afrobeat sound.
Oh, well.
Which we're going to hear in a few minutes.
Well, that is Fela's main claim to fame. He would never have been known. All his political activism and his social justice activities would never have come front if not for the fact that he was a masterful musician. Fela, like I said, when he came to America, he was still playing high life because he went to England and learned classical. Fela was a prolific classical musician. He was trained, you know, at the Guildhall School of Music, and he specialized in piano and trumpet. But coming to Africa, he couldn't play that. Nobody, he wasn't going to be playing classical music to Africans. So he went back and formed a high life band, came to America, and like I said, he was politicized. But as he was getting politicized, he was also being infused with the music that was playing here. And when he finally went back to Africa, there was a time when he was still a broke musician, no money. And he always used to go to his mom and beg for money, as we say. But his mom used to support him. So one day his mother said, Fela, all this music that you say you know, you are a musician, you have all these degrees from England. Because when you go out of Africa and you go abroad, it's like a big thing. You're supposed to come back with the spoils of whatever you've been. Why don't you join this so-called white man music and African music and see if you can come out with something that we can understand, we, the Africans, can understand.
It was his mother's idea?
That was his mother's statement.
Amazing.
That is Fela's story.
Wow. And so, he worked with other musicians, and they really came up with this sound.
Well, he worked with other musicians, of course. I mean, as a music, he wasn't playing alone. He had a very big and good drummer who is actually was the main key of his band, Tony Allen. You know, he worked with Tony, he worked with Ige Chukwu, but it was Fela's music. Let's not forget. I mean, he was the one who set down the music. He was the one who composed, set down the lyrics, and you know, made the music. And he came up with something he called Afrobeat. Then Fela started singing. Well, not started. Fela, at that time, Fela was singing in Yoruba, which is his, you know, his native language. He's a Yoruba person. In Nigeria, we have, in Africa, we have many tribes and many different languages. And like I said before, when the colonialists started forming countries, they never bothered if you were from, you know, they just cut off different people. So he was started singing in Yoruba language. And then somehow or the other, because of his politicization, he wanted people to hear what he was saying. So he started singing in Pidgin, which is broken English. You know, it's like a local patois. It's spoken all the way across West Africa. And that is when Fela really took off. His first big hit was called Lady. But unfortunately, I don't have that here. But, we can hear one of the songs that got him into trouble. This is not actually Zombie, which was the big one. But this is Kolo Mentality, talking about how our rulers have been colonially, you know, abused. You know, they were slaves before, but now, even now that they've been freed from slavery by the slave master, they haven't freed themselves. You know.
Right. So, Colonial Mentality, we're going to hear that song in just a little bit, or a piece of it. I mean, he did really long songs. Even on his albums, there were sort of no 3 or 4 minute, you know, hits. They were all long, and then in concert, they were even longer.
Fela did what he called compositions. And the way he looked at it was that the composition had to be complete. He was not just writing a song. He was a musician. He had been classically trained, and he was composing music the way he felt. He wasn't just going to play some words and play around them, and you know. So this was how he wrote his songs. This is how he composes music. And he thought everything was a complete piece from beginning to end, you know, like telling a story. You know, you have time that people are in a hurry, and time that people are slow, and time that people are happy, and time that people are sad in the same story. So there's no need just taking the happy part, and, you know, it's not the complete story.
Now, you knew him. You met him. You met Fela Kuti.
Oh, yeah. I was at the shrine quite often.
The shrine.
At the shrine, the Africa shrine. You know, that's where, that was Fela's nightclub in Lagos.
Okay.
The original shrine was burnt down by the military. The rulers of our country, who, instead of building things, burn things, they specialize in burning things down. The original shrine was burned down in 77. That was in Surulere. And he moved it to Ikeja. And that's where he got a space to build another shrine. And it was like going to church. It was a very, very intense and intimate place to be, you know. One of my fondest memories was when we gave a command performance to Fela, you know, of the island.
Now, tell us about that. You're an actor.
Yes, I am an actor. And I worked in England, I worked in a few places in Nigeria, in Cameroon, in Ghana, you know. But in Nigeria, I was working on stage and television, and the National Theatre commissioned us to do a production. It was also at that time around the late 80s when the anti-apartheid movement was at its peak, and we decided to do the South African play called The Island. The Island is Robben Island, where Mandela was spent, I would say, 90% of his imprisonment in South Africa. But the story was not about Mandela. It was about, I mean, again, Mandela was not the only one on Robben Island, you know. So this was a story about two young men who were picked up in Port Elizabeth and, you know, railroaded into Robben Island, and were in their cell. They were in a cell, and this was just a revelation of their life, going out to break rocks and, you know, just living there, and how they find, entertain themselves, happy moments, sad moments. It was a very intense play, again, about apartheid, you know. And when Fela heard that I was doing it with a very good friend of his called Larry Williams, you know, it was a two-man play. you know, he said, we must come and play it at the shrine. And Fela came in with his whole entourage. Fela always moved around with about 50 people around him, you know. And he sat there, like I said, he was the president of Calcutta Republic. And we put up the play. And there were other people, I mean, he opened the shrine for free, you know, and people came and watched it, you know.
Now, he was the president of the Republic. What was that? I mean, that was his, the place that he lived?
Calcutta was his home, where he lived. And he lived in Fela. I'm not saying he was rich, but he had enough money to go and live somewhere from his music, to live somewhere more reasonable. But he lived in the, I'm not saying the worst part of town, but in the ghetto.
Yeah.
You know, that's where he built his compound. That's where he lived, you know.
With his 27 wives and entourage.
With his 27 wives, his entourage, musicians, hangers-on, all his workers, his roadies. And, I mean, Fela had about 70 people at every one time working for him, working with him, working for him, working for the organization.
Yeah.
So it was like four or five houses, you know, and with a big wall around it, you know. And that was the Calcutta Republic, yes, you know.
Very interesting. I mean, somebody like that, just a natural leader, extremely talented, extremely charismatic, an incredible musician, incredibly creative. Then he tried to run for president, but was basically blocked every step of the way.
Oh, yes. I mean, he was... Mary Charlotte, like I said, a lot of people don't understand the whole African mentality. When I say that the political system in Africa has been skewed, it's been, you know, everything has been, you cannot come from outside and want to run for president. Because, okay, let me just tell you as a story. At that time, the army had been ruling Nigeria off, on and off for about 40 of its 50 years of independence. And the corruption inside the army, inside the political system, was so rife that they could not hand over power to somebody who might want to look into what they had been doing. So they had to get somebody who was compliant. The people who had been contractors under them, who had been benefiting from their largesse, the people who had been, you know, there's a lot of political manipulation, political arrangement that is put in place so that I know that even if you become the president tomorrow, Mary Charlotte, you're not going to dig into some crevices that I don't want you to dig into. Fela it's not that he ran and he lost. They wouldn't let him run. He was blocked from the beginning. He just couldn't get into the city. He formed a political party called the Movement of the People, MOP, and we all went around shouting, mop, 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 mop the city, mop the government, mop the country, clean it up. But, you know, this put a lot of fear into many people, you know? And, you know, before
like
any...
Like fear that he could have won.
He could have won.
Yeah.
Even if he didn't win, he could have shaken up the system so much that whoever would have, I mean, that the establishment candidate might not have won. That's the whole thing. Even if Fela didn't win, there were other middle of the road candidates whom his participation could have projected into position.
Exactly.
But because he was not there, you know, the establishment candidates had a free run, you know. Some of these middle-of-the-road candidates were not very popular personalities. They might have had good policies, but they were not... They couldn't galvanize the people and make them, you know, bring them up. But if Fela was running, you know, there would have been a lot of sensitization of the people,
yeah.
Which a lot of these middle-of-the-road candidates didn't have either the charisma or the money for. Yeah.
So... He then was persecuted by his government and jailed, and then he became well-known internationally because Amnesty International took up his cause as a political prisoner.
Well, Fela had been victimized by the government for a long time. Actually, one of the Fela's signatures was that he left from the stage to prison and from prison to stage, from stage to prison, long before this. long before the case that the admiral said. Actually, the word Kalakuta was from one of his first imprisonment that he suffered when he made a song called Mr. Who Are You? And again, in Pidgin, is, you know, we have these slangs that we, do you know who I am? I'm such an important person. You know, even if somebody is breaking the law and a policeman comes to arrest him, do you know who I am? You're talking to me? Do you know who I am? So fella's song was, Mr. Who Are You? Why are you so pompous? Why are you so, what makes you think you are above everybody else? And he was talking to the powers, you know? And that annoyed a lot of, you know, and again, it was not just the people who had money or who were high in the establishment. Because it was military rule, every little, you know, non-commissioned officer could mistreat everybody on the street. And when you talk, you said, do you know who I am? You know, and so the song went out, it went viral. And so Fela had been a thorn in the flesh of the authorities of the military for a long time. But I think it was in 1986 or something like that, when he was going to travel abroad, they had made a law that they call it the foreign exchange law. You couldn't carry money out of, you couldn't be in possession of foreign currency inside the country, even if you earned it legitimately. You know, when if you came to America and did a job and they paid you in dollars, you came to Nigeria, you must change that dollar into Nigerian currency. And so Nigerian government was the only person allowed to own the dollar or to own foreign currency. And this was when, again, the rogues who were in power were devaluing the national currency so that everything of value, the foreign currency was of value, must not be in the hands of common people in the country. So anyway, to cut a long story short, Fela had come to play in America, or I think it was the other way around. Anyway, he had been to either Germany or America and came back, and he had some foreign currency, and he didn't give it to the government. I mean, you know, it was not their property. So now he was going out again to play. Like I said, vice versa. Either he had been to Germany where he was paid in foreign currency and he was coming to America. Yeah, he was coming to America, I remember now. He had been invited to play in America. And he was coming out here, and at the airport, he was searched, and they found $2,000 on him. It's not money he stole. It's, you know, it was his legitimate money. They didn't say stole money or anything. It's just that he was in possession of money that was his. That was, you know. And like I said, they are trumped up charges. They just, you know, put him in prison for that. And, I mean, this is a crime that he could have been sentenced to, you know.
They could have just taken his money.
But he was sent to 5 years in prison. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison. And that really, you know, maybe because he was, his producers out here and everybody, I mean, there was a lot of international agitation about that. And then Amnesty International, the whole world. But with all that, Fela still was in prison for 2 years. And the Nigerian government didn't give a hoot about all the international action that was being taken until the judge who sentenced Fela came to Fela's, Fela was sick and hospitalized while still in jail. And he came to Fela's bedside and he said, listen, man, I am sorry. You know, you shouldn't be here. This shouldn't have happened. But my hands were tied. I couldn't. And somehow or the other, maybe Fela knew, or maybe his family members knew, they had this on tape. And that went viral. You know, the next day it was played all over radio. Judge apologizes to Fela, says conviction was, and, you know, Fela was released from prison with that.
And he gets out. He died of AIDS in 1997. But his legacy lives on in so many ways, including the festival this coming Saturday.
Well. Fela is now more famous internationally and all over the world than he was when he was alive.
Yeah.
The festival, Fiesta Fela, taking place in Santa Fe, when I came to Africa, to Santa Fe almost 15 years ago, I could count the number of Africans and the number of black people I met, I encountered in the fingers of one hand.
Yeah.
I mean, not in a day. I mean, in like a year, I could count. You know, I had Sisi, who was my niece.
Right.
But besides her, it was hard to see any. So we started seeing our community growing and everything, and we decided that we should be celebrating our presence here. And here we are, celebrating our presence in Fela's name. You know, what could be more exhilarating? What could be better? You know, the music, the fun, the art, you know, it's, you know, that's all Fela, that's what it stood for.
And it's all happening this weekend, this Saturday, from 11 to 7 at Rail Yard Park in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Kamaju Tadfor, thank you so much for talking to us about this wonderful man about your life.
Thank you, Marichalla. Thank you. It's a pleasure. I mean, doing this, this is really something that's very gratifying, and we intend to do more. This is our fourth year, and well, we hope it becomes a permanent Santa Fe feature.
Excellent. Well, let's hear some music now by Fela Kuti.
All right.